Reddick.
We'll convene a subcommittee of the Subcommittee of Ways and Means Public Safety. We left off last week with the solicitor for the State of Oregon. Mary, would you like to go ahead and proceed? You were walking through how the criminal appeals process works, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We had done a pretty quick tour through the criminal appeals process, what we sort of count as the five basic steps that someone can pursue to challenge their conviction. The direct appeal, the post-conviction trial, and then post-conviction appeal, federal habeas trial, and then federal habeas appeal. And just to put this in context of the presentation you saw last Monday and Tuesday for the mapping project, this is it's a very small but important part of that public safety system that you saw demonstrated on Monday and Tuesday. That this part is at least two of these pieces, the direct appeal and federal habeas, are required by the Constitution. The post-conviction is a statutory proceeding, and our role in this really is to help the state meet those constitutional and statutory requirements in the most efficient way possible. And I'm going to now turn to some of the numbers and the costs associated with this program. Thank you. The next slide shows approximately how those five different types of appeals are broken out in terms of the cost to the program. Out of the $12 million, you can see that about half of that is in direct appeals. One thing I'd like to point out on this slide is that the federal habeas cases, both appellate and trial, it's a much smaller number of cases, but it's more costly. And so when you look at the percentage of the costs that they take up, and then you actually sort of look at the numbers of cases we're talking about, those are more expensive cases for the state, both at trial and on appeal. The next slide, we're going to take a look at the numbers of cases starting with post-conviction trial. And this shows going back from 1995 through 2002 on a calendar year basis, how many post-conviction trial cases we've opened, closed, how many are pending. A couple of things I want to point out on this. In 2001, 2002, you'll see a jump in the number of hours billed on these cases. That's the red line that tracks through this chart. The Attorney General always has the flexibility to move people to respond to the greatest demands on the system. And we moved two positions from appellate to trial to deal with the backlog of cases in the trial division. We were getting to the point where we were having some judges basically demanding that we show up or they were going to dismiss the proceedings. We needed to be able to bring that backlog down. We've been successful in doing that. You can see that the backlog of pending cases has come down somewhat, and we expect that with those increased hours that we've devoted to this area, that backlog is going to drop further. The one thing, of course, in terms of our expectations, we right now is a tough time for us to be making any predictions about what's going to happen with the caseload because there's so much uncertainty about what's going to happen with the system as a whole. But we do expect to see a reduction in the number of pending cases we have. I wanted to mention that there are a couple of things, though, that could change that. We know from looking at what the court system has done that they have to reduce indigent defense costs, post-conviction cases are fairly low on their list as far as their priority list. Beginning March 1st, they will not be assigning post-conviction attorneys to any new cases because of having to deal with their reductions. And that actually will have sort of two impacts on the system that work in opposite directions for us. If attorneys are not assigned to cases, one thing that'll do is to actually sort of bring down the caseload. But the other thing that we can see happen is an actual increase in cost for the cases that are going through the system, that individuals don't have to wait for an attorney to proceed with these cases. And as more individuals decide to proceed pro se or without counsel, we will actually see probably the cost per case go up. When individuals appear without counsel, they are more costly to the system. Even if their issues are not more complex, they basically gum up the works and slow down our ability to respond to those cases. So we're not sure what's going to happen in 03-05 with this caseload, but we do hope that with the increased positions we've had in this area that we'll see the pending cases come down more. The next slide shows federal habeas trial. Similar information. Here we've basically been holding steady. The number of new cases coming into the system have been holding steady. The backlog has come down some. And in the larger book with the budget narrative on page 442, there is a chart that shows the comparison of how many federal habeas cases we handle per attorney compared to surrounding states. And if you have a chance to take a look at that, what you'll find is that Oregon is basically doing a lot more work with fewer people handling these cases representing the state than in some of the surrounding states. If we turn to the next slide, this shows the workload for the three different kinds of appeals: the direct appeal, post-conviction, and federal habeas. And then it also separates out the death penalty cases as a special figure that we keep track of. So far, those have been primarily on direct appeal. We've had now two on post-conviction. Those we keep track of separately because although they are very small numbers, they're extremely costly for us to handle. And in fact, we figure that each death penalty case represents between 0.3 and 0.5 FTE per case. So if we have five death penalty cases in a biennium, that is approximately two FTE that we have that are devoted simply to handling those death penalty cases. And as you can see with these numbers, we've consistently had much more than five per year, or per biennium, excuse me. The other thing to note on this one is our backlog of cases, the numbers at the bottom of the slide, that has gone up. We have less flexibility in the system, and as we start to lose resources, we can't continue to push that backlog further. We're going to actually have to start waiving appearance in more cases. We can't just continue to stretch out how long it takes us to handle cases. There's a limit on that. And we always try to sort of balance kind of how long we can stretch out those cases and when it is time for us to simply not appear in some of those cases. The next slide shows the average hours. The figures on the slide are for the direct criminal appeals, the first step in the criminal appeals process. And you can see that over the last several years, that's held pretty steady around 30 hours per case. And that's an average figure. To put that in some context, the PCR trial cases take approximately 20 to 25 hours per case. PCR appeal takes about 25 hours. The federal habeas cases, though, you'll see are much higher than these, the direct appeal and the post-conviction. Federal habeas trial cases take about 70 hours per case, and the appeals take about 60 hours a case. When we look at those death penalty cases, we're looking more around the average of 1,000 hours per case to handle those. Some of them have actually been coming in and looking easy, and have averaged around 750 hours.
Senator George.
You're doing such a great job, you're ahead of me. Backing up to the appellate criminal appeals workload case, you said that if you reach a certain point of backlog of cases that you basically don't show, what happens at that point? As far as the criminal that is making the appeal?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, that's a very good question, and I was going to touch on it later, but I'll answer it now because it's a good opportunity always to respond when the question comes up. When we start looking at what's going to happen as far as making reductions, we're very aware that we're dealing with a system, and you've heard that I know through the mapping project over and over again. But that there are some differences in what happens when we don't appear depending on what part of the system you're looking at. If we are talking about a trial proceeding, so post-conviction trial, federal habeas trial, if we waive appearance and don't show up, the state is not represented at all in that case, and in many of those cases, we'll simply lose. So what the criminal defendant is asking for, he's likely to get, unless the trial judge can tell simply by looking at the face of what the defendant has submitted, that there's no basis for giving him relief, he's likely to get relief. On the appellate side of things, it's a little bit different. That the Constitution requires the appellate courts not to reverse a lower court decision that's arguably correct. And so even if we don't appear, that doesn't remove the obligation from the appellate court to take a look at the issues being raised and to try to decide whether, in fact, the trial court was wrong. So if we waive appearance, in some respects, it's if you look at simply our part of the system in isolation, you may think that's a better way for us to go, is to waive appearance on those appeals, because the state arguably can still win the case, and in many times will. But if you look at it from that system perspective and you step back from it, what ends up happening is when we waive appearance, we're simply shifting our obligation in the system and our cost to the court system. And frankly, I mean, our appellate courts do an excellent job, but I think they're not as efficient as we are in dealing with those cases, because it simply is what we do. We know what to look for in those cases. So the difficulty is finding a way to provide the court with something, but maybe to reduce the kind of work that we do. So we may simply give them a very short, you know, here's an initial kind of answer, so that we're not simply shifting our cost and our responsibility to another part of the system and not reducing cost to the system as a whole.
Okay. Thank you.
And I think if we can go ahead and go past that one, Kevin. The next simply shows how the criminal appeals budget fits into the department's budget as a whole. We're about 4% at $12.93 million. The next slide shows that budget history. And you heard on Wednesday when the Attorney General was doing the overview about that we had changed from subsidizing criminal appeals. And that's why you'll see between 9901 and 0103 a large jump in the budget for this part of what we do. What we had done in the past was that a significant piece of the criminal appeals budget was actually picked up by the rate paid by agency and other fund cases. And between the 9901 and then moving into this biennium, we changed that so that we got rid of that subsidy and we're actually paying for the work that we do in the criminal appeals through the general fund money that we receive for the criminal appeals. So that's why the large increase there. And the next slide shows the reduction for the House Bill 5100 cuts. That translates into about 3.5 FTE. And in terms of the impact to the system, Senator George, that's what we were just talking about. That it will we're working now on prioritizing the kinds of cases that we work on and what we'll do. And I know we're going to have that for you later this week. But those are the kinds of concerns that we have to be looking at. The other thing to keep in mind when we're looking at the effect of those reductions on the work we do, as I said way last week, beginning out when I started talking on last Thursday about appellate in general, is that we're very reactive. We're not initiating most of the work that we do. We're responding to what somebody else is doing. And so as we see changes in other parts of the system, that's obviously going to affect where our reductions are going to occur, because the whole system is likely to start shifting as we're on unsteady ground right now. And then the House Bill 3182 reductions are about $1.4 million. And the effect of those reductions, it's the same as what we were just talking about. And that is the end of the quick run-through on criminal appeals. I'm happy to answer any questions that the members have.
Questions for Mary? I'll take this opportunity to convene the full committee. Now that we have full contingent. Thank you, Mayor.
Mr. Chair, the next thing on the, or next division on the agenda is the General Counsel Division. I believe Don Arnold is here, who is the Chief Counsel. A couple of things to keep in mind as they go through this presentation. Some notes to keep in the back of your head. The Attorney General is, the state agencies generally must use the Attorney General for any type of legal counsel. It is a statutory requirement. Sometimes it's interesting. I've been in the midst of a couple things where you have state agencies talking between themselves where there's not always agreement, and it's Mr. Arnold's job sometimes to work through some of those issues. Complexity of legal cases and the legal work is something to keep in mind. I think just as the rest of society is becoming more complex, the legal issues that this division and others are facing are more complex. Customer satisfaction is also There's always a concern for this group around the kind of work they perform, both in legal advice and review of contracts. Keep in mind also the impact of budget cuts on the workload of this division, as the attorneys of this division have been active recently, is my understanding, in working with agencies and formulating the budget cuts, making all sure that the rules are followed for notification and all the other things that go along with that. The final item would be whether, in terms of controlling workload of this division by state agencies, whether or not many of the directions or suggestions that the 2001 legislature put in budget notes or budget expectations in the budget reports, how has that followed? How has that panned out in terms of the workload in this past 2 year period? That, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Doug. Any questions before we proceed? No staff? Mr. Arnold, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Don Arnold. I am Division Administrator for the General Counsel Division. Let me say at the outset, I think I provided you probably with more material in these slides than in handouts than I'm going to be able to cover in any detail, so I'm going to go through this fairly quickly. Obviously, if you have questions as I go through it, I'd be happy to respond to any questions you may have. Next slide. The General Counsel Division is charged with providing the day-to-day legal advice to all state agencies. So the work that we do really is as broad as the work of state government, and that is very broad. We have organized the division into 9 sections. Each of these sections has a group of attorneys that work with agencies that have at least somewhat similar missions. So, for example, the Natural Resources section in the division would provide advice to all of the natural resources-related agencies. The Education section would provide advice to all of the agencies that have some relationship to education, and so on. There are 2 exceptions to this general way we've organized, and that is the labor and employment section and the business transaction section. And both of those groups of attorneys represent every state agency. So whenever, for example, a labor issue would come up in an agency, no matter which agency it was, that issue would go to attorneys in the labor and employment section. The general statutory charge for the division is found in ORS 180.060, subsections 2, 5, and 7. These are very broad charges, and I guess that befits the broad scope of what we're supposed to be doing with agencies. But in general, we provide written legal opinions to any state agency that requests advice. Provide all legal services requested by state agencies or state officers, and assign legal counsel to each state agency. Now, there are other statutes that impose more specific duties and responsibilities on the division, and I'll mention some of those as I go along. The mission of the division is to deliver timely and cost-effective legal service that meets the needs of all of our client agencies. Most of what we do is in direct response to requests from state agencies. And later on, I'm going to talk about one of the budget notes, which deals with the agency gatekeeper system, which is intended to provide a mechanism for state agencies, for our client agencies, to control and monitor the work that's coming to us. And this was a cost-saving measure that was directed by the last legislature, something that has been implemented. But I have to say, as a practical matter, most agencies had already I've been doing something like this probably for the last 5-6 years. Most of the work that we do consists of written or oral legal advice. There is a growing tendency for us to provide our advice in less formal means. A lot of it, for example, is now delivered by email. Now, that has good points and some not so good points. On the good side, it's quicker and it's usually a little less expensive than doing advice through a formal written memoranda. The problem that it creates for us is we really don't have a good system in place to keep track of that advice. So we may have an attorney provide advice last year on a subject, and another attorney gets a similar question next year on the same or a similar subject, and we really don't have a way to go back and find that earlier advice. And that leads to a lot of reinventing the wheel, sometimes to providing inconsistent advice, which neither the agencies we represent nor our attorneys like to do. We have some litigation in the department. You've already heard from the trial division and the appellate division. You're soon going to hear from the civil enforcement division. All three of those divisions are heavily oriented toward litigation. What we do is more, I would say, more specialized litigation. For example, we represent the Department of Revenue in the tax court and in the tax magistrate court. Or we appear in Land Use Board of Appeals on behalf of a variety of state agencies. I'm going to talk more about preventative legal advice and training and about ADR later on, so I'm going to skip that for right now. We have two performance measures that are specific to the General Counsel Division. The first looks at average time from receipt of a contracting document to the first substantive response back to the agency. And we think that's an important measure because agencies are very concerned about timely response, not only with contracts, but with all of our work. We've targeted 13 work days as turnaround time for this measure. And notice that the measure refers to a substantive response to the agency. Now, in most cases, that's going to mean approval of the contract. But there are going to be cases where the contract we get to review raises so many questions. Question?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can I just get during your presentation, just a response to, for agencies where the contracts would be quite complex in terms of like a contract with the general contractor for a major project with the Oregon Department of Transportation, or a contract with the Department of Administrative Services for like the construction of that new building on the mall, what sort of a review process and what the timelines are for that, if it's distinct? I mean, there's one thing, a fairly simple contract for the purchase of something, and those kind of contracts that might be extremely complex.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, that's a very good point, and obviously all contracts are not the same, and they don't take the same amount of review time. What we would hope to do with a contract like you're describing, a major construction contract, would be to start working with the agency early on, back at the time when they're planning the project, and help them work through the construction documents as they're putting them together in the agency. I can give you an example of how that works to the benefit of the agency, a quite recent example. Department of Transportation, as you know, has what they refer to as fast-track construction projects, and these are projects that arose out of the $500 million that they obtained this biennium for highway construction and reconstruction. They had a major project that came to us, I think, a week or two ago. We had been working with them right along as they developed the construction documents. They were a little late in getting this contract over to us for review and said they needed it in like 2 days. Now this was a major project, but we were already familiar with the contract. We were able to recognize some inconsistencies in the contract that needed to be changed. There were some things that needed to be amended to make it legally sufficient, but we were able to meet their deadline. Now, that would never have happened if the first time we saw that contract was when they brought it in the door for legal review. So one thing we have been trying to emphasize to agencies is let us work with you up front as you're going through this stuff, because it's going to save so much time on the back end, and it's going to result in such a better product for everyone that it just makes sense to do it that way. But to go back to your specific point, that was an example with ODOT of how you could do it within this 13-day period. But had we never seen that before, and if it were in the shape of some contracts that we receive, it could have taken 6 months to work through it. Because you're at that point, if you're making major changes in the contract, you're back into negotiations with the contractor who may not like the changes that you think need to be made.
Mr. Chairman, follow up. So then your idea would be, participate early and probably including participating in a request for proposals process and the request for bids process also then.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, that would be ideal from our standpoint. And I have to say that we're doing that more and more often with agencies.
Thank you.
I just had a question on your – how did you pick the target of 13 work days, and why is that relevant?
Well, we wanted something that would push us to turn around these things as quickly as we can. We had some data on what our turnaround time was. That is, we had begun collecting some data, and it looked like we were in the ballpark with 13 days. Now, frankly, one concern that we have with this number is, and I'll get into this in more detail later as well, but we have a number of initiatives underway looking at the contracts that we're now reviewing to determine whether we can eliminate review of some of those contracts and create exemptions from the need for legal review. And I think what that is going to do is more and more of the contracts we're going to be seeing are going to be the more complex things that are more time-consuming. So, and that's appropriate, but it's likely to, it's likely to make this 13-day turnaround time tougher to meet.
What percentage of your time is spent on contract?
I mean, as a general counsel myself, so little time is spent on contracts. More of my time is spent on dispensing general advice to the various corporations and individuals that we have. What percentage of your time is spent on, for your department, is spent on contracting versus?
Mr. Chair, I don't think we've really tracked that number, but I would guess a fairly educated guess would be 20%.
Representative Butler. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Relative to the 13-day target turnaround time, I just wondered what the what other states were experiencing on turnaround time under similar situations.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I don't have an answer to that question. I'd be happy to try and check with other states and see if they kept that kind of data.
I think that would be important to know.
I just like to say, as we move away from this particular performance measure, to me at least, it's not particularly, while I appreciate it may be a good internal goal, I don't know if it's a good outside performance measure, knowing the size and complexity of the types of contracts that the agency has to deal with. So, we can talk more about what's counted in what's counted out maybe at some other time. We don't need to discuss that.
Mr. Chair, in all fairness, it may be that other states don't have any kind of measurement, that, and that would give us some indication as to whether or not that was important.
Yeah.
And their way of thinking, too.
And the second performance measure deals with, it's a client satisfaction measure, deals with the percentage of state agencies responding to a client services survey. It ranked the quality of legal services provided as good to excellent. And this would be on a 5-point scale, with excellent being 5. We did do a survey in 2002, and I'm going to talk more about some of the results of that, but you can see here the response to this particular question was 88%. Our target number is 90% on this. And just a little background on the survey, we sent out 325 survey forms. We got back about 150, but that number is a little misleading because some of the survey forms that were returned consolidated comments from a number of people within the agency. So the actual number of people commenting exceeded 150 by some amount. The next couple slides are more information from the 2002 survey. And by the way, I'd be happy to provide the committee with a copy of the complete survey form and the results if you're interested in seeing that.
Well, I believe we have that. I told the committee that we would make that available to them.
Okay. And the second slide, again, as I mentioned earlier, timeliness is very important to the agencies. This slide focuses on various work in the Department of Justice, but in particular in general counsel, and ask for their perception of timeliness in these various categories. And one category that is not listed here, but which was covered on the survey, was timeliness on contract issues. And I'll mention that because I know there is a lot of interest on the general subject of contracts. The response there was about 88% and always usually timely.
Can we discuss, before you switch on to sampling of the factors affecting service, can you talk maybe a little bit about those items, you know, since we are the budget committee looking at your budget, where the deficiencies were and in terms of the survey, where the largest problems with the department were in regards to that, and maybe what, if anything, we need to focus in on as a budget committee in terms of making sure that those services are properly provided to state agencies?
Well, I think the two areas that I would point to that came out of this survey were assigned attorneys understanding the agency and understanding the problems, and secondly, anticipating legal problems. And let me give you my take on what's causing some of that. It used to be that it was very common for general counsel attorneys to be invited to go to agency staff meetings, to go to board and commission meetings, so that they heard discussion as the agency was making decisions about what actions it was going to take and heard the rationale for what's behind those actions. In the last 4 or 5 years, agencies have really been ratcheting down their willingness to have attorneys go and attend these sorts of things. We get called in, and there are exceptions, but we get called in as a general rule only to respond to a specific question. And as a consequence, often, you know, the attorneys are handed a legal issue, but they have no context for that issue. And I know it can be frustrating from the attorney's side. It can also be frustrating, I think, from the client agency's side, because then we have to spend time trying to figure out exactly, well, where does this question fit in with what the agency really is trying to do and with its priorities, and, you know, what are ways we can maybe adjust, give them options to do it in a little different way that still meets their objectives but takes care of legal problems. So that has been a problem for us, not having the access to agencies so we can gain understanding of of what they're trying to accomplish in their programs. And at the same time, it has been made quite clear to us, both through the gatekeeper system and messages from agencies, that they don't want us doing things like, reading professional publications to identify problems that may be out there for the agency. You know, they for the most part take the position, you respond to a question when we call you to respond to it. And, you know, in the budget situation that agencies are facing, that's perfectly understandable. But it does lead to, I think, somewhat of a disconnect between the agency and their counsel, and it does affect the quality of the service that they're getting from their counsel. And I think, to some extent, that's reflected in some of these survey comments.
That has a follow-up, and then I'll let you ask your question. One, do you charge agencies by the hour when you come to public hearings, come to meetings, and those kinds of things? Are they charged? And two, you identified the issues. What is the Attorney General's office doing to remedy, to bridge the gap between what your perception is and what agency's perception is, to make your legal services more effective?
Well, Mr. Chair, yes, we do charge for going to all of those meetings, and I think that's probably the primary reason why our invitations to them have fallen off. Now, that's not a new thing. We've always charged for going to those things, but I think tightening budgets has made agencies much more conscious of it. And what we're doing to deal with it largely is an educational effort. We try to talk to agencies about the benefits that are there for them if they have an attorney who knows more about what they're trying to accomplish, knows what's important to the agency. What are your important policy goals?
But as to my second question, what, if anything, is being done to try and bridge that problem that you perceive from the General Counsel's office?
Well, I thought I was responding to that. We're trying to educate the agencies that there is benefit in having us attend those meetings.
Like, how are you educated?
Well, I've had talks with agency heads. I've talked to the DAS director. Our attorneys talk to the agencies that they work with, the boards and commissions that they work with. It's an informal process, but it's an ongoing process.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one concern that I have relative to these satisfaction surveys, and that is the story that's left untold. Well, we've got 83% saying, yes, that's fine, or 88% saying, I guess it's this other 12 to 17% I'm concerned about. Number one, they don't have a choice to go to law firm B. I mean, this is all you got. And so if we've got 17% that are upset or 12% that are upset and are unsatisfied, I 90%, quite honestly, in a captive audience that we have here is probably really not a very good number to shoot for. So I am concerned about the fact that we're not seeing the other 17% and what they would be willing to do if they had an alternative. And that's just a concern I wanted to express, Mr. Chair. I don't know that there's anything to be done about it in this committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm jumping ahead a couple of units, but that's okay. Because my question is, it's a sampling of factors affecting the services. Down at the bottom is negotiation and drafting of contract amendments to reduce agency expenditures. And I think it fits with some of the other questions that we're talking about relative to this survey. And it sounds like you're moving to kind of help them to be educated about the process. But are there, like, standard boilerplate contracts for construction of buildings, construction of highways, this sort of thing, that, in fact, an agency could become familiarized with so they would understand? Because we hear on the backside complaint from people who contract with us saying, what a nightmare, I'm going to add 10% next time. And so Is there anything, it looks like you're addressing this, but is there anything we can do to make sure that they would understand how to proceed? Here's a boilerplate. Here's a form, you know, 2.5, as far as they begin their process, it would save money for them.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, yes, we're doing a lot with regard to boilerplate contracts. I mean, just as an example, Department of Transportation.
I want a workers' comp.
Department of Transportation, we've provided with standard construction contracts that they probably, well, I don't know what the percentage is, but it's a high percentage of their construction contracts are used, they use these standard construction contract forms, and they don't have to come see us for those. So, And I'm going to go into more detail on the issue of forms and standard provisions a little later.
Pardon me for jumping ahead of you.
Let's let him go.
Okay. These next three slides are a sampling of some of the factors that affect the workload in the division. The first slide is focuses on issues that are specific to budget revenue shortfall issues. And again, just in the interest of time, I'm not going to go through each of these in detail, but let me hit a couple highlights. Probably no surprise to you that we're seeing a lot more work in the labor and employment area. We're getting a number of questions from agencies about layoff notices and bumping rights under union collective bargaining agreements and so forth. We are getting a number of questions about the statutory constraints that may exist that would prohibit or inhibit an agency from reducing various programs that it may be operating. And for some agencies, Department of Human Services is a good example. We also have a federal overlay of federal requirements that may at least slow down an agency's attempts to reduce their program levels. We're spending time talking about agencies' authority to terminate or suspend or reduce the dollar amount of contracts for a variety of things, ranging from contracts that are in existence to build new buildings, to contracts with various providers. And we've been working with agencies like the State Treasurer and Department of Administrative Services on options for dealing with state cash flow problems, solutions like selling of tax anticipation notes or securitization of the tobacco settlement revenue stream. And by the way, in connection with these three slides, I've also provided you with two handouts. One is a list of some of the federal laws that are currently generating legal issues for state agencies. And the other is a list of some of the interagency and intergovernmental groups that division attorneys are participating in. Some of the other issues we're seeing from agencies include Department of Transportation's new access management rules. Early this biennium, they adopted a group of, I think it was about 70 pages, of pretty complex regulations that that set the criteria for property owners adjacent to state highways obtaining access to those highways. Those rules and the related statutes have generated a lot of legal questions. I understand that Department of Transportation is planning in the near future to undertake a new rulemaking in an effort to simplify the current rules. We've worked with agencies on implementation of HIPAA, which is the Federal Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. This is a piece of complex federal law that affects not only state government but also private industry, particularly the healthcare and the insurance industries. But for agencies like the Department of Human Services, it's going to mean some fairly massive changes in the way they handle a lot of the health-related information that comes into their possession. We've been working with Department of Revenue on a number of appeals from large food processing facilities or electronic manufacturing facilities. These industries have been hard hit by the global economic slump, and they're contending that the economy has virtually made their facilities worthless, and consequently they want the Department of Revenue appraisers to significantly reduce the appraised value of those facilities. We're working with a number of agencies with regard to some new federal laws that grew out of the terrorism events back in September of last year. One of them is the U.S. Patriot Act, which has imposed a number of requirements on several state agencies. For example, it requires that higher education monitor much more closely access to a number of its labs, requires that they track foreign students who may be registered with the universities and keep in contact with federal authorities about the status of those students. Also imposes some new requirements on Department of Motor Vehicles relating to licensing of truck drivers, for example, who are licensed to haul hazardous materials. So there are spots of impact across a number of state agencies that are flowing out from these new federal laws. The Klamath Basin water adjudication is a major effort that has been underway for several years now, and it's likely to go on for years into the future.
But we know anything about that.
Right. I used to represent a portion of the folks in northern Klamath Basin, Mr. Chair, and that's going to continue on for a number of years, I'm afraid.
Representative Butler, Mr. Chair, I'm sure that's true. That's certainly consistent with what we're hearing. For some of the committee who may not be as familiar with that, this is a proceeding by the Water Resources Department to determine water rights in the whole Klamath Basin, basically. There are currently 700 claims to water in the basin that are being adjudicated. There are 5,600 contests to those claims. There are a number of federal agencies involved, a number of tribes, and it seems like virtually everyone else who lives in the area. We've had an increase in the number of applications that have been filed for new energy facility siting with the Energy Facility Siting Council, as well as an increase in the number of hydro licensing applications. And that includes some applications to decommission some of the dams that are currently in service. And these are all generally multi-year application processes that involve multiple state agencies and typically with the hydro projects also involve the federal government, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. This chart shows pending files in the General Counsel Division, and as you can see, the first year of the biennium, we did have an increase in caseload. That has leveled off in the last 6 months, and I anticipate that it's probably going to stay flat for the rest of this biennium and probably into next biennium. I think we're going to see decreases in some areas. I wish I could predict exactly where that would be, but I can't. But I think I can predict with a fair amount of certainty there are going to be some increases in other areas, in particular in the labor and employment area, as budgets continue to be squeezed. If there is additional ODOT construction, I know there's talk of providing Department of Transportation with additional money for highway construction and reconstruction. That would generate some additional work. And then I don't think we're going to see a fall off in the foreseeable future in the work that we're doing with agencies, just in helping them cope with agency program reductions. The next slide is similar to the last one. It shows, again, trends in workload over time. You can see for this biennium, again, we had some increase at the beginning of the biennium. It's leveled off, and again, I don't foresee a change in that for the coming biennium. We put a lot of emphasis on cost containment activities in the division, and for us, a lot of that means providing preventive advice and providing training to agencies. We have a very active training program. One major component of that is the public law conference that we put on every other year following legislative sessions. We typically have 500 to 600 attendees at that conference. We offer 25 to 35 different programs covering a variety of different subjects. Some of them are of general interest, like public meetings and records law or state government ethics issues, and some are more specialized and targeted at, for example, human resources people and agencies. In addition to the public law conference, in a typical year, we also do maybe 150 to 200 smaller training presentations of one sort or another. And that could range from one attorney meeting with six or eight Department of Revenue auditors to give them 3 or 4 hours training on how to make a more effective presentation in the tax court, to a consolidated effort by general counsel attorneys and the trial division attorneys, for example, to do a program for 3 or 4 agencies on how to avoid tort claims. We also have a number of publications that are prepared by the division for use by state agencies. Probably the most frequently used are the Public Meetings and Records Manual, the Public Contracting Manual, and the Administrative Law Manual. And I brought with me the Administrative Law Manual if anyone's interested in taking a look at that. These are all updated following legislative sessions so that they incorporate whatever changes in the law may have occurred. In addition,
who bears the cost for those publications?
Mr. Chair, we sell the publications. I believe they're $25 a piece, and that doesn't cover all of the cost of preparing them, but it's intended to recoup some of the cost. We also are responsible for developing a number of different types of model rules for use by state agencies, and I've listed some of them here. These also need to be updated following each legislative session. We put a great deal of emphasis on appropriate dispute resolution, and we have a number of activities in that regard that take place in the division. For example, we have developed a pre-screened mediator roster. This is a computer database that contains information concerning mediators, private sector mediators who are interested in working with state government. And they, in this roster, they are in this database, they list their areas of expertise, the kinds of cases they're interested in handling, and so on. The database is accessible by agencies who can query based on the kind of case they have, what they're looking for in a mediator, and the database will give them back a list of mediators who meet their criteria. We've also arranged for an exemption from DAS, from the usual contracting rules, where agencies are hiring mediators off of this mediator database. So we have an expedited hiring process available for agencies. that includes form contracts that have been pre-approved, so it's really a pretty quick process for the agencies. We've developed a master list of state agency employees who have experience as mediators. And these are employees who would be interested in serving as mediators for other state agencies and whose supervisors have said that would be okay, that they would allow the employee to spend a couple days trying to resolve a dispute that arose with another agency. We provide a number of different training opportunities. We provided training both for attorneys within the department on ADR issues, and we've made available training to state agencies on ADR. Most of this next list, I'm going to talk about at other points later in the presentation, so I'm going to skip over it. I do want to mention one point. That's the internal policy on contract review. This is a policy that we've developed to provide guidance to our attorneys on exactly what they should look for when they're reviewing contracts and on what they shouldn't, what remains the agency's responsibility. And I think from the agency standpoint, the important point is the agency is responsible for business risk decisions. We can inform the agency about the risk that they may incur with a particular contract, but ultimately it's the agency's policy call as to whether to do that. While I'm on the subject of contracts and cost containment, let me point out one other thing. This is in a handout which I've also provided you. In the last 4 or 5 years, we've been fortunate to be able to hire a number of very experienced business law and transaction attorneys. We had been sending out a lot of contract work because we didn't have the staff in-house to handle it, and it was costing agencies a significant amount of money. Now that we have this experience in-house, we've been able to bring that work back into the department. And as you can see from the chart,
you know what?
It's on the back side, I think.
Yes, that's right. It's a two-sided
back side of the graph. Outside.
Yeah, as you can see from the graph, there's been a significant reduction in contract overflow work sent outside the department, and that's resulted in significant savings to agencies. The division is entirely other funds supported through the billings that we make to agencies for the service we provide. You see from this pie chart, in the governor's balance budget, general counsel division makes up 13% of the total department budget.
Can we maybe go back to the contracting piece sure. while people have that maybe in front of them to ask maybe a few questions while we're on this particular piece. So we ask some questions. We had raised the issue the other day about the $75,000 limit or threshold, I guess, not limit, but threshold for having your office look at agency contracts. I had also asked a question in addition. One, is that does it seem to be working? And two, has it lowered litigation costs or not? Where are we at? Can you maybe speak to that particular policy?
Mr. Chair, certainly. The $75,000 and the $100,000, I'd say they form a floor for contract review. That is the general rule, but the law also authorizes the Attorney General to provide exceptions from those general criteria, and he has provided a number of exceptions. Two of the budget notes deal with exceptions from the requirement for legal sufficiency review of contracts, so I farther in the presentation have a number of things to say about that. But in general, let me just say We have an ongoing effort to identify contracts that really don't need to be reviewed, or to identify things that agencies can do, and I put high on the list providing better training for their contracts officers that reduce the risk of contracts that are handled by those agencies and make it more likely that we would be able to exempt those contracts from review. So
I'll wait till you get to the budget.
Mr. Chairman, while we're switching, can I ask
Senator questions? George.
Is there anything that would prohibit an agency, for example, in the contracting area, to go out and hire an employee who does in fact have a law degree and may be familiar with that sort of thing? Is there any prohibition against that sort of thing?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, there is no prohibition on that. There is a prohibition on employees of agencies practicing law, that is, providing legal advice to agencies. But there are a lot of lawyers who are employed by state government, and I suspect there are a number of contract officers who are probably lawyers. And if they can use their skills to draft better contracts, that's not something we're objecting to.
But, Mr. Chair, they would still have to, if they meet all the floor or whatever, they'd still have to run through the AG for
Possibly.
Review.
Mm-hmm. That's unless it were exempted. And,
right.
And as I'm going to get into more detail later, one of the exemptions we're looking at is an exemption that would be based on the training and the skills of the particular contract officer. So.
Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, we'll have an opportunity to come back and address some of these questions specifically as we come close to work session, I assume.
Yes, and I think what we want to do is we're going to discuss a little bit more when we get some of the responses to budget notes. But hopefully we raise the issues today or the next couple days so that
okay.
we can answer them. Then we'll have time to answer those before we go.
In the governor's balanced budget, you see a breakdown here by class of expenditure. And as you see, personal services constitute 86% of the general counsel budget. That's by far the biggest piece of our budget. In essential packages, 030, the inflation and price list adjustments amount to $159,700 for inflation increases. And if this were not included in the budget, our response would be reduction in services and supplies, probably focusing on training for staff, travel related to training, purchase of publications, that sort of thing. To meet that decrease. 2002 third special session, we have a reduction in the budget of $85,500 that relates to elimination of the 2003 COLA for manager salaries at salary range 38 and above. The House Bill 3182 reductions amount to $3,500,000. The effect of that would be, going back to the earlier slide, since most of our budget is personnel cost, this reduction would result in probably a net decrease of 10 to 12 attorneys and 5 to 7 support staff, somewhere in that area. And obviously, that kind of reduction is going to reduce response time to agencies, probably going to mean that we probably have to identify some areas where we would no longer provide advice. And it probably would also result in some advice going back outside to outside counsel because, there's going to be some questions that just need to be answered.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask a question, and I'm going to, I think this is the this is a question. Go ahead and be asked at this point.
Okay.
One of the concerns that I've got is that when we look at the core mission of the General Counsel Division, one of the things that we need to ascertain is that the core mission is to provide this counsel. Then the 3182 cuts should be prioritized, and I recognize that in relationship to the mission, the mission statement may have several things that you're going to accomplish as a general counsel. And then at the other side, when we talk about 3182 cuts, the priority should probably start with the bottom end of the list being the ones that are cut. And not having examined in any detail the actual budget document, I would think that the reduction of legal services available to state agencies from the General Counsel as being the very, very, very first cut that's priority out of your mission. And so I guess I'm going to ask a question at some point in time. Is there some lights that can be turned off? Are there some dues that we can delay paying? Is there some travel? If there's not $100 worth of travel in here, then I guess we can't cut $100 before you cut the services to departments. But I guess I look at the 3182 cuts in relationship to the mission. And if I see the very first things in the mission being cut off before I see travel or dues or those kinds of things, Mr. Chair, I want to tell you what. I'm not going to come unglued and come across the table and go for throats, but it's going to become pretty close because we've got people that really need services in this state, and I appreciate the offer that there'd be $3.5 million worth of services generally cut right off the top, but I need to have a real lot better feel about what there are as far as expenses in this package before I make the statement that I'm not very happy with
that. I think they did try in the open. 0300, and we did talk a little bit about some of those travel and other expenses as well, but it's not to the extent I would argue as the 3 million. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think everything this department does is basically service to other agencies. So I think we're a little bit in terms of semantics when you're talking about a budget reduction, there may be some direct services on specific legislative matters, but the training, the manuals, all of those things are services to state government. So I don't know if I draw as fine a line in the sand as Representative Butler is drawing, that I think everything they do is matching up with their mission statement. And if you've got to cut 10% out of the budget, it's going to come out of services because there's nothing else left. Nothing else left to do.
That's much more diplomatic than my approach.
And I think that as we look at these, but as a committee, especially like the General Counsel Division and other divisions that are provisions of state service, so we still always have to be asking ourselves, are they doing it the best way they can? Because it still has effects on those other agencies and really the programs that they provide. And so I think that Representative Butler brings up a good point in terms of trying to focus on those types of things. And I think that's what we've tried to. I think that the general fund money that flows directly into this agency for its direct services are really fairly limited to a couple divisions in particular. This does not happen to be one of them, but it is general funds, which comes in this agency as other funds. So as we turn things upside down and shake them out. And see what comes out with that.
Mr. Chair, I really am very sensitive to the core missions of these states, but I'm anxious that the first cuts don't come from direct services if there are lights to turn off somewhere in the building.
Well, and I think that we will get more into this discussion as we discuss the rate, the particular rate. I think that this is relevant to the rate discussion that we will be having as to how it affects all of the rest of the agencies who pay in to the Attorney General's office and our bill on an hourly rate basis.
Mr. Chair, I would just respond that I think the process that we will go through in making these kinds of cuts is exactly what Representative Butler described. My only point is, given the proportion of our budget that consists of personnel costs, there would be no way to make a budget cut of $3.5 million without cutting into personnel. And our personnel, their purpose in life is providing those services to state agencies. So it is going to reduce service. There'd be no question about that. Policy package 152. This is the only policy package for the division in the governor's balanced budget. I mentioned earlier in my presentation that we have a problem in the division in keeping track of the legal advice that's provided. And what we really need is a database that we can dump this advice into a searchable database and then be able to go back and see what we said 3 years ago. And ideally, that database would allow us to incorporate into it even the advice that we provide by email. In other words, convert the email to a database format and put it into the system. We have identified this as the number one need in the division. We have worked with the department's IS department to identify ways that we can use current department software to accomplish this. We think we can do that. We have, in fact, a pilot project underway now to make sure that this is feasible. What we need is one position, to serve as database king or queen and make sure that the system runs properly, that what should go in goes in, and that miscellaneous junk that shouldn't be in there doesn't end up in the system. So the purpose of this policy package is to provide one paralegal who would get this database up and running and then make sure that it's maintained.
I don't know what the agency's doing, but I might suggest to someone who looks at provisioning IT solutions like this that you might look at some of the off-the-shelf IT packages because they're specifically designed to do just what you're requesting, to put in the particular question to identify who the people are and identify a response that is searchable and meta tagged and everything else so that it is properly available. So,
well, Mr. Chair, I know that there's software out there. Frankly, we're trying to do this on a shoestring and use the software that the department currently has in place, and I think we can make it work.
Only hope.
Mr. Chair,
lots of shoestrings turn into knots,
in my experience. I'm trying to do something like that.
This policy package will have a zero price tag on it because they are using, they're moving things around within their budget to fund this position. So the policy package will be just position authority and using existing funds to pay for it.
That's correct.
Is this going to be available to your outside agency to search the database as opposed to just making it internally available?
Mr. Chair, we haven't thought about that, but I can see problems with it. A lot of the advice that we provide is confidential, and we'd have concerns about how broadly we opened up access to that. Turning to response to budget notes, we had six budget notes that were specific to the General Counsel Division, and the first two deal with contract issues. Some of this I've discussed at least in part earlier, but let me go through it in a little more organized way. The first budget note deals with contract forms, and it requests that we collaborate with agencies in increased use of templates and standardized forms for contracts and procurements, emphasize the use of technology in preparation of contracts. We now have in use over 125 different standardized contract forms or procurement documents. We're continuing to update those forms and to add new forms. In the last biennium, we've updated 32 construction-related forms, 13 new forms for Department of Administrative Services and Department of Transportation, and developed 7 new forms for Department of Education. We're also trying to make use of technology to the greatest extent we can in connection with our contract work. We'd make all of these forms available on Department of Justice, on the Department of Administrative Services, and Department of Transportation websites. They're downloadable from those sites for other state agencies, for that matter, for contractors out in the general public. We provide agencies with electronic versions of all of the approved templates and forms that we develop to make it easier for them to use. And virtually all of our communication now with agencies and with outside vendors is electronic, sending draft documents back and forth and comments on contracts.
Is the state contracting system where the systems are being used somewhat standardized for tracking contracts, tracking the red line versions? Are we able to do those kinds of things now, or do we have everyone on different types of contracting software?
Mr. Chair, I certainly wouldn't say that we're all on the same software. In fact, I believe for a while, and Doug, you may know this better than I do, but we'd had problems with Department of Human Services exchanging documents because for a while Department of Justice was using WordPerfect software. Then we switched to Word, but meanwhile, Department of Human Resources, which had been on Microsoft software, switched to WordPerfect. And so I think for the most part, state agencies are using Microsoft-based software, and with those agencies, there really is not much difficulty in transmitting documents, but there certainly are exceptions to that.
Has the department set some standards by which to interface with your attorneys in terms of setting standards so that you're not going back and forth and back and forth trying to do document conversion and being able to track? I mean, one of the largest things in legal review, at least that I've noticed, is in the contracts area, is just our ability to redline contracts properly and not go through and reread
over and over
again on versions. And so I'm just wondering if you're able to set some standards, or you feel like you can't set those standards, or where.
Mr. Chair, I think we have pretty well standardized that within the Department of Justice in our exchange internally, but not sure we have the ability to do that with regard to other agencies, and particularly with outside vendors who were, you know, a lot of our communication is with contractors sending drafts back and forth.
Senator George.
You do assure that agency that this is costing you more money because of our time, right?
Well, perhaps we should.
I think it would be nice to at least have the conversation with the Department of Administrative Services, who are setting the statewide standards for provisioning IT technology, to have that conversation with them about setting the standards for procurement and contract review. And I know that at least internally, to go back and forth that way. I know externally we can't control the world,
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that's a great idea. In fact, for a while I thought that Department of Administrative Services was going to set standards for all state agencies with regard to computer systems and software compatibility, but I'm not sure that's going anywhere.
Well, in my morning committee, we get to sit and we have IRMDF, so I will make sure.
Butler and I will make sure. They transferred some things across to you guys at the last, so we will now throw the ball back to them. I also did have one other issue just while I was on it that I wanted you to note. On Policy Package 152, I don't know if you guys have run that. Your current plan through the Department of Administrative Services, IRMD, to make sure that that is going to be a manageable and sustainable system that we're putting in place. I would like DAS IRMD to take a look at that before I'd be willing to bring that up to make sure that we that it is something that's sustainable into the future, because they have those technical resources to do that.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Kelly Fields with the Department of Administrative Services. I think the answer I'll give you is we have not. I did not send this package over to IRMD, so I will do so.
I just think of a package of this nature that has some potential savings and good communications issues.
That's a good point.
I don't want to get it down the road here 6 or 8 months and have you provision a lot of things internally and then have it blow apart. So.
Good point. I'll send it over for their review.
Mr. Chair, turning to budget note number 2, this deals with contract review exemptions and asks us to explore class exemptions from legal sufficiency review for various types of contracts or procurements, consider agencies' demonstrated experience and expertise in drafting and managing contracts and procurements as part of the class exemption process. I have a handout for you. It's a one-page front and back sheet that lists the current exemptions from legal sufficiency review that the Department of Justice has enacted by administrative rule. And then on the other side, there's a list of 26 class exemptions from legal sufficiency review. Recent activity in the class exemption area includes a new exemption for leases of submersible lands for state lands, some new exemptions for or updated exemptions for Department of Human Services for corrections, and for Department of Transportation. And we continue to, this is an ongoing effort, looking for contracts that we can exempt from review. Our goal is to pare down the number of contracts that are coming to us so that what we end up with really are the more complex and complicated contracts that agencies are entering into, or contracts that may not be complex necessarily, carry a lot of risk to the state. And contracts that might fall into that class would be contracts, for example, for software development, where agency might only spend $200,000, but they're buying a software system that could have millions of dollars of impact if it doesn't work. We have underway currently two efforts. We're doing a general review of our administrative rule class exemptions, and we have another effort underway involving a committee consisting of Department of Justice and I think 5 of the major contracting agencies. And we're using that committee to look for innovative ways to provide for exemptions. And one of those ways is something I mentioned, I believe, in response to a question from Senator George, looking at the contract officer rather than the contract itself. And seeing if it makes sense where an agency has a well-trained contract officer who's doing a good job with a particular kind of contract. When we see those contracts coming over, we're not finding a lot of problems with them. Maybe we exempt contracts that are handled by that particular contract officer. So those are some of the things that we're doing in the contract exemption area. The third budget note deals with lay representatives. Lay representatives are 8 employees of our client agencies. who are authorized to appear on behalf of the agency in administrative hearings. This is a statutory carve-out from the usual prohibitions on non-attorneys practicing law. It requires approval by the Attorney General for an agency to use lay representatives. This is something that has been available to agencies for quite a while, I'd say at least 8 to 10 years, but maybe longer than that. And prior to the beginning of this biennium, I would say most agencies that have any substantial number of contested cases were also already making heavy use of the lay representative opportunity. But at the beginning of the biennium, we sent out a letter to all agencies. That letter is an appendix in your notebook. This letter urged agencies to take another look at lay representative opportunities, examine the contested case hearings that their agencies participated in with a view of to try and identify any that where they weren't using lay reps, where it might make sense to do that. We also ask all of our attorneys who were involved with lay rep or with contested case hearings to take a look at the hearings they were appearing in and try and identify any that might make sense to authorize agencies to use lay representatives in. And that effort did generate a few more requests by agencies to add to lay representative authorization. But as you can see from the bottom bullet on this chart, we ask the chief hearings officer at the central hearings officer panel, a panel that was created by the last legislative session and which handles the great majority of contested case hearings for the state, we ask him to take a look at his records and identify the number of cases in which assistant AGs appeared. And as you see, he says they handled about 16,000 hearings in 2002, and we appeared in about 140 of those hearings. And that would be consistent with our view of about the number that we're appearing in. So it's already a very small number. We continue to whittle it down slowly, but we're pretty much down to the point where the kinds of cases that we appear in are things like the Board of Medical Examiners is revoking a doctor's license to practice medicine, and you know that doctor is going to vigorously resist that. So those are the kinds of cases where it is appropriate that we appear. Budget note number 4 deals with the agency gatekeeper policy. I mentioned this policy earlier as well. This was an effort that actually had begun before this budget note was developed. The Department of Administrative Services and the Department of Justice worked with a task force, a work group of agencies that was set up by Department of Administrative Services to develop a policy on control of access to legal service by state agencies. And this work group came up with a model policy for agencies. That policy was distributed to all agency heads in a joint memorandum from the DAS director and the Attorney General. The memorandum enclosed a copy of the policy and stated that every agency ought to adopt this policy or something similar to it. And essentially what the policy provides for is agencies appoint one person who serves as a gatekeeper for all requests for legal services going to the Department of Justice, and that the agency maintain a data bank within the agency of all advice that had been previously provided to the agency. So, I mean, that had a twofold purpose. It let the agency, gave them an internal resource, so if a question came up, they could check and see if it had already been answered. But it also had one person who knew everything that the AG was being asked to do and could you know, stop similar requests from going over or make the decision that this really isn't an important question, not important enough to have the department spend funds to have the AG look at it. So, and that, you know, particularly in these budget times, has resulted in a constriction of work from some agencies.
And I guess that's why I would encourage you to look, and that's why to look at a particular IT kind of software that's a particular type of question that you can provision by agency that would have access that they could look at it. And I looked at your form for legal assistance. Is this, do they email this in, or they're probably...
They can email it.
Okay, but it doesn't probably go into a database, or does it?
No. Okay. Budget note number 5 deals with labor and employment section. The direction here was to attempt to resolve labor and employment disputes cooperatively, seeking to reduce the number of disputes resolved through adversarial proceedings. What I've shown on this chart is the total number of litigated cases that the labor and employment section brought to conclusion in the year ending 701 and the year ending 702. And you can see there's a 10% or so increase in the number of those cases. But from the budget note standpoint, the important number is really the 68 and the 72. And those numbers represent the percentage of those cases that were resolved without going to final decision in the hearing. So in other words, they were settled in one way or another through mediation or negotiation or case was withdrawn by one party or another. So I think we're moving in the right direction under this budget note.
And I assume you have standard releases for all those.
We do have standard releases. Budget note number 6 deals with outside counsel bidding process. It asks that the Attorney General explore the possibility of developing a bidding process for outside counsel that would assure that we obtain competent legal counsel, but at the lowest possible cost. The Attorney General convened an internal group to take a look at this issue. That group brought back a proposal for modification of our current rules for screening and selection of outside counsel. The rules, among other things, established that one of the criteria that would have to be considered in making hiring decisions would be lowest overall cost to the state in the hiring process. The Attorney General has now adopted these recommended rules as a temporary rule for the department. And as we'll get about 6 months of experience with them and then move toward permanent adoption of those rules or something similar to them. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that concludes my presentation, but I'd be happy to respond to any additional questions you might have.
I have a question in regards to how do other states do their attorney general process? Do most people set up, I'll call your approach the law firm approach, where you set up and build agencies out? Is that how most attorney general's offices are configured throughout the country? Or is Oregon unique upon to itself?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the attorney general may be in a better position to respond to that than I am, but I think Oregon is certainly in the minority in the sense that we bill for our service. I think most other attorneys general's offices don't do that. But there are a number of offices that are set up similar to the way we are. It's just that they have direct appropriations to support their office.
Well, I guess in light of the comment that you made early on about attorney general, about agencies not involving attorney generals in the process of whatever rulemaking or whatever the particular item may be, I guess as somebody who serves as a general counsel, I'm included in a lot of that stuff, which I think saves us legal time and money and everything else on the back end. I'm just wondering, Hardy, and maybe you should speak to this, is do agencies have an opportunity, like if I'm the director of X agency, let's use like DHS for an example, and we have all these big new HIPAA provisions, we have all these other things, you know, a lot of, especially DHS, I would think, would want to have maybe legal counsel that was readily available that you could walk across the hall and grab hold of if you were the director of DAS or whatever. I'm wondering, as an agency, if I come to the Attorney General's office, do I have the option of saying, I want to hire this I'm going to provision X amount of my budget for a full-time person on my staff to serve as a general counsel, and you won't bill me on an hourly basis? Is that done? I'm just wondering what the options are for agency directors.
For the record, Hardy Myers, Attorney General. Mr. Chair, first of all, go back to your original question. I will see if I can get a specific number for you as to states in which the consolidated legal services model has been the
And I don't know the history in Oregon. I'm just going down this path in light of the question that was raised, and maybe a different question. I don't want you to do a bunch of research, but maybe the other question to you is I don't know what the history that got us to this billing provision kind of Attorney General's office, and I guess that's the question for you is, does it work? Have you seen other states that have different models? You know, is it more restrictive to our state's ability to really manage itself legally, in your opinion?
You know, ultimately, Mr. Chair, it's a value judgment for the legislature as to how to structure those services. We can give you, I can develop for you and provide a little bit of a historical background as to why the legislature chose to move to this consolidated model. And I think those reasons are rooted in reasons of efforts to gain consistency of advice, of avoiding independent, unconnected locations of legal authority, counseling agencies perhaps in very contradictory ways, and to place those services under one accountable official. And I might say, I think that in those states where there has been a change in form, it has been a movement toward the consolidated legal services model. There's been some interesting writing on that by Dave Frohnmeyer, among others, that I'll be happy to supply the committee, that summarizes the advantages of that model for your kind of updated thinking about it. The separate question, though, of how it's billed, I think, is to some extent separable from whether it's consolidated.
Right.
Or
not. I'm thinking of a hybrid kind of.
To no conclusion yet, I might say that since I've been Attorney General, we have recurrently given thought to how we might try to structure that system differently, the consolidated system. Now, we have in some instances established retainer-type agreements with one or more agencies that move away from the strict hourly model, PUC being, I guess, the primary example right now.
Okay.
And we're very interested, I think, in trying to move further down that road as well.
Representative Hansen.
Well, thank you. Just in that same vein, I would be interested if at some point, and I don't think we're there, because it would appear that you're doing some very good work with seminars and things in developing information for preventative law. But if that billing system ever becomes an impediment to creating if you're only billing for services, we want the people to be coming forward and getting the advice before rather than crisis management. And we should be very careful in terms that we have a system that encourages that. And I certainly don't know what the answer is, but it sounds like you're investigating those types of approaches. And I think we, as the legislature, should be willing to let pilot project go forward or maybe look at some different billing models that might encourage as much preventative law as possible.
I would, Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I would agree, and I think that there are potentials for arriving at somewhat different finance structure while still retaining the advantages of the consolidated model. I might add, if I could, that I think there's been real advantage, however, over time for the legislature not to have chosen to finance the Department of Justice with a single general fund appropriation, because, for one thing, as we the current environment, I think it has eased so much the amount of destabilization of the department that occurs when there are these budget gyrations. And while on the one hand, I'm not claiming for the department any greater immunity from the budget turmoil than any other agency, still I think to the extent that that kind of turmoil can be reduced, particularly in terms of the professional provision of services to the government itself, I think it's to the advantage of the government.
Representative Devil, or Senator Devil. I still can't get used to it. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the Attorney General answered really most of the question I was going to ask about, you know, being part of this budget turmoil. I think one of the difficulties that we face, if the Attorney General might comment, is that I think you could make the case that the services that your department provides actually ultimately probably saves the state from additional liability, probably saves them from some departments doing things that they maybe should not be doing, et cetera. But at the same time, in the budget turmoil, what we're dealing with is obviously, I think, the current governor, during the campaign process, said the Oregon Youth Authority was one of the best examples of something we'd done well in the last decade. And it's one of the major targets for budget reductions. There are people that make cases to us that taking away certain pharmaceuticals from people that are mentally ill will end up putting them probably not in the mental health system, but in the probably in the criminal justice system. And it's sort of the same kind of analogy that spending on prevention makes sense. But in the same light, how do we deal with the fact that we don't see a single forecast anywhere that doesn't look worse from one week to the next? And how would you have us treat your department in terms of, treat the Attorney General's office in response to that, and how we might have to end up treating other agencies?
Mr. Patrick, Senator Devlin, of course that's the bottom line question that the subcommittee will have to face, and I guess I would respond to it at this point this way. I don't think that any department or agency is going to be exempt from bearing a portion of the pain that the budget constriction is going to impose. The most specific answer I can give you right now, Senator Devlin, is that, A, I hope that this subcommittee will call upon the Department of Justice to bear a proportionate share of the pain and not a disproportionate share. That is, that you won't feel there's some reason to punish the department as opposed to distributing to it what hopefully we could work together to try to identify as a fair proportion of the burden of the deficit. And secondly, I think the key question becomes ultimately how that is decided upon as between the general fund component of the department's work and the legal services component of the department's work. The latter, of course, implicating the issue of what you budget to the agencies for their own services and supplies budgets in order to finance legal services. And it may well be, Senator Devlin, that the most responsible conclusion from a budgetary standpoint is that some amount of that burden gets borne in both of those overall areas, and that we work with you to try to identify how that can be accomplished in the least damaging way to the service missions that you've ordained the department to carry out. I mean, and their missions to the government, missions to law enforcement, missions to individual citizens. I mean, there are different constituencies that are importantly affected by the department's operations. It's a rather, I'm sorry, that isn't yet a specific dollar answer, but I'm trying to advance how my own thinking has revolved around the bottom line question of, all right, what is your share of the burden? And how should it be allocated?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Attorney General, I guess part of the thing in terms of, I think your answer was very responsive, actually. Specific dollar, they're not even giving us specific dollar amounts yet in terms of, because no one knows how low forecasts can go.
But again, just to reemphasize one point, the way our budget's structured, it does, I think, create these two sort of large choices. The issue of what does the government invest in its own legal services, and what is it going to invest in the public safety, law enforcement missions of the department that are the general fund programs.
Anything further from the Attorney General? Mr. Attorney General, I like the fact that you and Kevin have very similar ties on today. Kevin obviously got the memo, and the rest of you didn't, I see.
Kevin, did you send me the memo? Which way did it flow?
I think if there's no further questions for Mr. Arnold, what I'd like to do is just have Mr. Boss and Ms. Pellegrini do a just real quick overview, so they're thinking about it as they go to sleep tonight, of just Civil Enforcement Division, and kind of just just introduce the mission and your department structure, and then we'll be done. Since we are in such tight timelines, I appreciate you staying for only 10 minutes of presentation. I know your time is valuable, but we appreciate it. At what, $97 an hour? We know your time is valuable. Are you billing the legislature?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, no.
We have our own attorney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Fred Boss, and I am the Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division. With me is Ms. Cheryl Pellegrini, who is the Attorney in Charge of the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection section of the Civil Enforcement Division.
One of the greatest tools for every legislator to know about, by the way, in my opinion.
And I agree, Mr. Chairman. We will be breaking up our presentation into two parts. I will present the overview of the division and four of the sections of the division, and Ms. Pellegrini will be focusing on her particular section. The Civil Enforcement Division is made up of five sections divided by practice areas. They are the Charitable Activities Section, the Civil Recovery Section, the Family Law Section, the Medicaid Fraud Section, and Ms. Pellegrini's Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section. It is the second largest division in the Department of Justice. The Civil Enforcement Division is generally the plaintiff's civil trial division of the Oregon Department of Justice. We sue to either recover money for the state or to enforce a particular law of the state. There is one section, the Medicaid fraud section, that has roughly 50% of its work criminal prosecutions in the financial or in the Medicaid fraud area, prosecuting folks that would violate or providers that violate the Medicaid statutes. Generally, we, as a division, try to push work down to the lowest competent level that it can be done in order to maximize the most valuable asset, or the most expensive asset, I should say, which is the Assistant Attorney General's. What we have listed in this slide are various ways in which we use our paralegal staff, our investigative staff, and our auditor staff in order to work up the cases, and we are generally almost exclusively a litigation division, in order to work up our cases so that we can maximize and leverage our attorney's time. Mr. Chairman, is our overview. I can start into the various sections, or I can broaden the overview.
What was your plan for how you were going to go next?
I was going to go through the four sections other than financial fraud. Ms. Pellegrini would then do a presentation of the financial fraud section, and then I would come back for the wrap-up and talk about the various budget reductions and that type of thing.
What's the will of the committee? I don't want to start off on a path that
we don't want to go down today. Cheryl, how long is your general overview on your division? I mean, what was your plan?
Mr. Chair, I was thinking that I probably could tell you what I need to tell you in about 22 to 25 minutes, tops.
Okay. Well, we're not going to stay for 22 to 25 minutes. As much as I like you and your division.
Having 7 minutes. I could give you a broad idea.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Devlin.
Since Ms. Pellegrini seems to be anxious to fully inform us about her division, and I would not want to cut anyone short, particularly someone that's been waiting here to testify, I think it might be best, not because of my own personal concerns, even though I have other things to do.
There goes but, the 7 minutes.
but to go on to tomorrow's meeting.
Okay. I think we'll go ahead and do that. We'll go ahead and start tomorrow. We are going to have a pretty tight schedule, so if you could pare down the 22 minutes, make it 20, that would be good, Cheryl. We'll start off tomorrow with the Civil Enforcement Division and try and make sure that we get through that and the rest of our schedule tomorrow. If we can do that, if the department needs any direction, like we talked about the road, we're going to work. Beyond that, there's nothing else. We're adjourned.
Thank you for calling it well enough.